Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What are we talking about today?
All right, we got a full agenda. Cole's going to be running through some economic indicators, including retail and housing data. I'll touch briefly on the FOMC meeting from last week, along with the summary of economic projections released. And then I'll also mention some of the themes that we're watching. So four themes for 2025 versus CRE for the second half of the year. And then finally, Cole's going to close it out with some of his CREFC conference takeaways. But to kick it off, Cole, how about we jump in with the economic indicators?
Yeah, it sounds good. I was watching a lot last week. Most of the data that came out last week is related to housing, but we'll go in chronological order of releases here. And one of the first data points was actually retail sales. This is advanced data for the month of May. It came out on June 17th. So U.S. retail and food service sales did decline in May to a seasonally adjusted level of $715 billion. And that was the sharpest drop on the month in more than a year. Retail sales are still up compared to May 2024 by 3.3%. And the broader period of March through May, so covering a bit of that tariff turmoil in April, was actually up 4.5% year over year. So perhaps get some front running of spending in advance of tariffs. Now, mind you, the data does cover spending on automobiles and across food service in addition to your traditional retailers. And so take some of the data with a grain of salt. But I think this is important for two reasons. One of the reasons we look at it is give us a good idea what the consumer has been up to. I said there might have been a little front running and spending in advance of tariff turmoil. But I think more specific to CRE, and I know I've called this out on the podcast before, is that you can see the breakdown of retail spending in this release by type of store. And so I think that's really important, or it carries some important implications for us in our industry. So I'll call out a few of those. And it's worth mentioning as well that the data is not inflation adjusted. So you may see positive annual figures for spending growth at some of these store types, but it could still mean that spending is declining in real terms. So let me break it down for us. One of the largest increases on the year was actually in furniture and home furnishing stores in May. Spending was up 8.8%. Non-store retailers, which is the vast majority of which, though it is not broken out explicitly in the advance data, is e-commerce. And so this was actually up 8.3% on the year. It's been pretty consistent throughout the last few years, that growth rate, somewhere in the 7 to 9% range. You saw some growth in grocery, up 2.3% on the year. But again, that's fairly close to the general rate of inflation. And so it could be that spending is actually flat on the year. General merchandise stores, which include your kind of Walmarts, Targets, even your warehouse clubs, spending at those stores was up 2.2%. So very close to grocery. Building materials up just 1.1% on the year, or rather at building material stores and electronics stores. Spending was down on the year, minus 1.9%, so posting outright declines. So again, consumers are growing fairly cautious in some of these categories, or at least they were in May in response to tariffs and uncertainty. So I think, and you see this already in this May data, some of the spending is being channeled into other big ticket retailers. It's reinforcing some demand for e-commerce. I think if it were to be split out, you'd see discount retailers doing quite well and your essential goods formats. While grocery might be down in real terms or is flat, but is still up on the year nominally, I think this is one category to keep an eye out for. But definitely some interesting stuff in retail. Where there was a lot of other data last week was in the housing space. One of the measures that I'm not sure we've covered on the show too often was the housing market index. This is a product of the National Association of Home Builders. They release the NAHB Wells Fargo Housing Market Index. It's sometimes called the Home Builder Confidence Index, but it's the HMI. This came out for June on June 17th. And it's an index on a scale of 0 to 100. Above 50 represents the majority of builders feeling confident about the state of the housing market. This index fell to 32 in June. That is a 2-point drop from May, and that is the lowest reading since December 2022. And if you were to chart this data kind of all the way back over the last 10 years, this is the third lowest level, or actually longer than the last 10 years, this is the third lowest level since 2012. The early kind of pandemic onset in April 2020 being one, and late 2022, of course, at the start of the rapid rise in interest rates. Now, all three components to this index, which are current sales, future sales, expectations, and buyer traffic, declined on the month. Another stat that's not included directly within the index that was worth calling out, 37% of builders reported cutting prices in June, and that's the highest share since they started tracking that number in 2022. So not too much data there through history, but important to note that it's the highest share since they started tracking. Historically, declines in the HMI have actually foreshadowed actual reductions in construction activity, so a good leading indicator. So suggesting here that single-family supply is going to continue to wane. NAHB did state in the release that they expect single-family starts to be down in 2025. I think this has some direct implications for multifamily. If this pullback does come to fruition, it could absolutely extend renter demand if they have nowhere to channel it. Recently, a lot of the demand for single-family homes has been absorbed by the new housing market because of the existing home market is frozen. But it looks like with construction rates being so high and the conditions just not being right, that the new single-family supply is going to trim significantly. Job growth remains pretty strong in the U.S. Multifamily fundamentals seem to be holding up, so should be interesting to see what happens. Now, how builders are feeling is different than what they actually might do. And so it's fitting that we got the new residential construction numbers just a day later on June 18th, though this is for the month of May. This release is from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Showed that total building permits, so this is inclusive of single, multi, and everything in between, duplex, triplex, quadplex, permits fell 2% on the month and 1% year over year to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.4 million. Building starts fell 9.8% on the month and 4.6% on the year to a seasonally adjusted level of 1.3 million. Now, completions rose 5.4% on the month to 1.5 million, but we're actually down on the year 2.2%. So all signs in the report actually point to a pretty prolonged cool down in new multifamily supply. If you were to just break out that segment of the new residential market, starts fell 30% on the month to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 316,000. They were still up a bit on the year, 5%, but the really, really important number here is completions. They were flat on the month, but down 6.7% annually. So that's the fourth straight month of annual declines. And over the past 12 months, starts have trailed completions by a historically wide margin. The number of units that are under construction is actually the lowest since 2021, so right before the boom. Now, I think the implications here are pretty clear as well. Demand continues to hold steady for multifamily. We've already discussed it from the previous release in relation to HMI that there's still some single family affordability challenges, and now it's becoming more difficult to deliver new single family supply. And I think particularly as the deliveries for multifamily slow down, this is supporting that story we've talked about a few times about later 2025 and beyond, multifamily rents potentially picking back up, especially in some of these markets where the wave of multifamily construction is peaking. not a new story to too many folks who listen to the show and hear us talk housing a lot, but I think the fact that the HMI data and the new residential construction data are starting to line up with one another, and the fact that we're going to get another few releases here shortly after I discuss these about existing home sales, new home sales, I think the story is pretty clear. But Omar, that was not the biggest thing that happened last week. I think a lot of our listeners are probably paying attention to this one, but the FOMC meeting, want to give us a rundown of what Chairman Powell told us?
Yeah, I think that some of those economic releases might have been bigger than the Fed meeting, but
they weren't anticipated. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. There we go. I do think that the housing, right? Even though you mentioned that we've touched on it before many times, and we'll continue to touch on it. That's an area that I could absolutely see some. There's growing momentum. We're here in New York, and that's a top issue for our mayoral politics, which are happening.
And this is like, just everyone's largest expense. It drives every part of your life.
Exactly. And I've just seen more. Yeah.
Yeah.
More and more stories.
Theory of everything. Yeah.
Exactly. I think we'll keep touching on it in the future. But yes, another big piece that came out, or another big event that happened last week, at least within the borders of the U.S., was the rate decision. So on Wednesday, the 18th, the Fed, it was largely anticipated, continued to hold interest rates steady, and they were really maintaining the Fed funds benchmark range at 4.25 to 4.5%. This is the fourth consecutive meeting that they've taken this wait-and-see approach. But heading into the announcement, this was really no surprise. The markets were really widely anticipating this no cut. But the market participants, and I would say we were interested more in the press conference of how Chair Powell was going to really address questions from the media, really around tariffs and what the outlook going forward would be, as well as this meeting was one of the four times during the year when they released their summary of economic projections, which is essentially capturing the FOMC members' aggregated views of key metrics across the economy for 2025 and the 2 years beyond, so for 26 and 27. And that really helps set the market expectations, not around just the decision within the one meeting, but also roughly where the FOMC members see the economy and the policy rate going through the end of the year and beyond, as well as looking at the ranges to see, okay, where do they disagree with each other? But ultimately, in the press conference, Fed Chair Powell expressed really, I'd say, optimism about the American economy's prospects, while noting that the central bank really anticipates gaining greater clarity on tariff-related pricing effects during the summer months. But he also highlighted that the employment market metrics really still remain like quite robust, even though there is some softening around the margins. And he ultimately described the labor market as it's not an area of concern. But another key thing that came out of the press conference had to deal with just broad uncertainty. And Chair Powell said that the current policy rate allows them to be flexible and to be reactive if necessary and responsive if necessary. He did highlight that the level of uncertainty is pretty prevalent across all forecasts, whether it's within the FOMC or across other economists. And he just wasn't hearing, or there was a lack of confidence, and he just didn't see much conviction, which I think that's a tough one. He built us up with the soundness of the economy and it being great, but then to say that he's seen a general lack of conviction in the forecasts, I think it's balanced and I think it protects the statement. But I think that was one of the themes that stood out to me, at least in that press conference. But then with the release of the SEP, or the Summary of Economic Projections, a few points I would highlight there is that, and we saw this kind of play through the media cycle that followed immediately. Also, I think this is going to be trickling out through the mid-year outlooks, that containing more of this stagflation concern. What became apparent in those Summary of Economic Projections was that real GDP growth is being revised down, inflation is being revised up, as well as unemployment, is being revised up, or at least the expectations for these metrics in the near term, changing in directions that you don't necessarily want to see it move in that direction. And that kind of paints a challenging environment. But what I would say is, if you go back and look at, I think some of the most accurate calls were for this higher for longer, right? And that was a key theme coming into this year. I should have looked at Google Trends to see when that phrase really picked up, but that was probably around 12 to 18 months ago of when we were really getting into this, okay, what does higher for longer mean? Well, higher inflation, higher rates, and ultimately that's often paired with somewhat slower growth. So even though the projections from the SEP did change from the March projections, and they moved in ways that you ideally don't want to see them move, we're still in that higher for longer. So some of it, I do think, still remains. But where does that bring us for CRE? One thing that I recently went through and did, we put together a number of our, like, the kind of key themes for CRE that we can see playing out through the year. And so now we've gotten the backdrop from the Fed and their views. I think that these themes actually hold up quite well to that. The first theme is this concept of price versus value. So despite there being many declines already that we've seen over the last 2.5 years across CRE, in terms of we've seen transaction volume really come down, and the price at which a lot of assets are transacted at have also come down. We've also seen that come down on the non-transacted assets and on the values that these are being marked at. And so while that gap was really huge when we were first going into the rate hike cycle, that gap has narrowed a bit. But I do think that there is still a gap between kind of price of what somebody would pay for an asset and the value of an asset on kind of books. And that gap is still there. And as we're in that higher for longer, that gap needs to get addressed, because that mismatch between price and value is likely a key contributing factor to decreased levels of financing, as well as decreased levels of transaction activity. Another key theme is really the emphasis of and the focus on operations and cash flow, generating cash flow from assets, because that cash flow or the income portion of that return is critically important in an environment where that appreciation by cap rate or a smaller and declining discount rate, that's not going to be driving as much of the return. And so that means that owners are and portfolio managers who are looking to increase kind of their overall return that they realize from their assets, they got to roll up their sleeves and really get more into the operations. So that focus on really increasing the cash flow yield from their existing portfolio, or identifying assets if they're looking to acquire new assets, that, you know, making sure that they're comfortable with a business plan or the operations and the game plan of how they're going to get more return out of that asset through more efficient or just improved operations. So I think that's a huge theme as well. Another major theme I just call lumpy transactions. Then this really stems from the fact that while the cost of capital remains high for most participants in the capital markets, those with scale or those with a big brand are able to fundraise and just get and secure financing way better than those without scale or kind of no name brand. Or to make this super simple, really, the big are getting bigger, and capital allocators are finding ways to really tap into sources of capital previously not targeted, and are ultimately taking market share from smaller incumbents or smaller entrants into that space. And that plays into the theme of the growth of private markets, or some may refer to it as shadow banking, or that certain activities as shadow banking. So essentially non-banks performing banking functions. And I think that this is a huge theme here. So if the big are getting bigger and there is just a huge amount of appetite for transactions, but you still have that kind of price value gap, there is a opportunity to do more larger transactions. right? Whether that is portfolio sales, a whole entity or company transactions. I think we're going to see that make up a more meaningful portion of market activity and is something to watch. So even if until financing costs either come down and they're still, and unless financing costs come down and the availability of capital improves for the smaller players, I think that those with capital, which are the bigger firms, are going to be the ones that are most likely to transact. And they're not looking, they're not shooting squirrels and they're not shooting rabbits. They're going for elephants, right? They're going for big check opportunities where they can actually deploy those, the large amounts of capital. And so that is either through whole company transactions, whole portfolio transactions, or ultimately some sort of consolidation play at scale. And then the fourth theme for you, this has been one that's been on my radar for quite some time, and I'm excited about it because I really do think it is playing out, which is this real asset merge. And so what I mean by the real asset merge is that the scope of commercial real estate, or what we consider under the umbrella of CRE, is widening. This is not a new phenomenon, right? If you go back to the 60s and said the phrase commercial real estate, that generally implied office, industrial, and retail. Multifamily wasn't quite there. Maybe come up to the 80s and multifamily was there as well as hospitality. And that when people think of CRE and even new analysts coming in today, when they are taught what's in CRE, they're usually taught the five main food groups being industrial, office, retail, multifamily, hospitality. But now that includes seniors, student, and then a alphabet soup of BTR, SFR, IOS, STR, as well as life science and some special purpose. So that this kind of broadening scope, not entirely new. But what is new or newer is data centers. And data centers are playing this really critical role of this next phase of the real asset merge. And the role that they are playing is really a linchpin, right? So they are connecting CRE to infrastructure and to energy, other real asset groupings that are huge opportunities. And the reason why data centers are playing that is because they're huge. You could have somebody who sits in a classic infrastructure group look at data centers and say, yeah, that's part of our universe. And then you can have somebody from CRE look at data centers and say, yeah, that's part of our universe. But it's a part of both of their universes. The securitized space very much shows that, and how these deals get financed shows that competition. But what we're also seeing now to make this real asset merge really come to fruition is that you're seeing regulations effectively being pulled back that allow different types of capital to access these private markets. And you're also seeing a lot of these fund managers line up and build platforms to support capturing the opportunity of deploying money into this space. I'm super excited by this kind of real asset merge, but it's only going to be accelerating. And it's something that will take many years to play out. But I do think that we are very much at the catalyzing phase of that being underway. So even though there was no immediate rate movement news in terms of interest rates, and even though we're in this higher for longer environment, I do think that there's a lot of new and exciting things and trends to watch. So those are four themes: price versus value, operations driving performance results, lumpy transactions, and the real asset merge. I think those are key themes that we're watching going forward, and hopefully we're right on some or all of those. But Cole, I just recapped some of our views and some of our opinions, but you were just at the CREFC annual conference here in New York, and you were hearing a bunch of other views. Absolutely. What were you hearing there?
I did want to mention something, another good transition here is that some of the original data centers were financed with ABS, and a lot of the new ones are being financed with CMBS. And so that perfect example of one of the things going on here. But I'm sure most of our listeners, or a lot of them, are familiar with the Commercial Real Estate Finance Council. They had their annual conference here in New York just a little under 2 weeks ago by the time we recorded this. But it's a trade org that really is, it came about in the 90s to service, CMBS joke, the CMBS industry. But it's really expanded in recent years to include other sources of capital, you know, traditional balance sheet lenders, your banks, but also insurance capital, all kinds of other alt lenders. There's also some third-party data providers and other folks that really are in the CRE debt space to discuss the current state of the market. And this is a nice mid-year check-in. We probably did an overview of some of our thoughts on the podcast from the January conference, but this is really their mid-year conference. So financing concerns about CRE are definitely front and center. But since you've got all kinds of folks who are here, the sessions also touch on macroeconomic trends, property level fundamentals, and really just a full view of what's shaping the CRE financing landscape for the rest of 25. So I have five themes for you to complement and mirror in some ways the four that we've been talking about. But I did want to call them out here, and I'll say this again, but if you want a written version of this summary, there is one available on the Altus site that I've put up. We'll include that in the show notes. But those five themes, the first of them is that April 2nd, or Liberation Day, to the CRE debt market was really a blip, not a breaking point. Debt issuance did drop in the 2 weeks surrounding, but in May, shot right back up. Single asset, single borrower volumes in 2025 are still well above what they were in 2024 at the same time. And it was boosted by a surprising wave of office deals. So they make up a huge chunk of originations, or at least of issuance for CMBS. The next was that the five-year loan has really taken over. But is it really 5 years? Because extensions are definitely baked in. This might be tested, though, because the first wave of the five-year loans, that's from 2021, their maturities are coming due fairly soon. And so this will reveal whether or not these were truly short-term instruments or if they need to be extended. And Omar, you mentioned this, but this was talked about a lot. There is a ton of capital out there, but everybody's chasing the same big deals. They're focused on these kind of core, low leverage, institutionally owned, managed assets. Everybody's looking for the same thing. So while there's a lot of kind of dry powder out there, folks are looking at these same deals. The fourth theme, policy uncertainty and issues with operating costs are really starting to be reflected in underwriting. Higher property taxes, labor costs, material costs, due to tariff concerns, they're kind of already flowing through there. And then lastly, this is a catch-all, but if you were to just talk to folks at the conference about property fundamentals, seem fairly resilient. If you break down the different asset categories here, a lot of them are holding up in terms of performance. Class A office vacancy in a lot of markets, New York was called out a lot, has dipped to record lows. The data center boom and surging AI-driven demand is obviously a big topic. The domestic consumer has been pretty strong despite the kind of April bump. And that's really benefited retail and hospitality in a way that I think a lot of people were concerned about. One piece that I thought was interesting to mention is that hospitality, while a lot of folks were worried that international travel having dropped since January was really going to hurt the hospitality sector, that spending only makes up like anywhere from 5 to 8% of hotel here in the U.S. And so it might be more in some markets, but even the folks who talked about New York specifically or LA or San Francisco doesn't seem to have really impacted them very much. Even as the overall CMBS delinquency rate has ticked up quite a bit, it's at 7%. It's as high as it was in 2014. A lot of the distress in CMBS remains concentrated in aging office and Class B regional mall. If I were to package this up, tie it in a bow, send it off, at the January conference in Miami, I think the most common phrase was cautious optimism. So at that point, panelists, attendees, folks who are floating around, not attending the conference at all, were expressing hope that interest rates would stabilize or gradually come down. They were hoping that new equity would come to the market, that transaction activity would recover. But by the June conference, a lot of this quote cautious optimism had, or at least the language had disappeared. You know, the mood at the conference, not very pessimistic, but it was very grounded. I think They had 5 months of actual data behind them. You know, we have put out a report using all this data showing that transaction activity is either flat or still declining across a lot of sectors. And so I think what you've seen there is that a lot of the participants in the CRE debt space, they're just more realistic about refinancing risk, uneven sector performance, and some of this uncertainty surrounding monetary and regulatory policy. We're just a few months into the new administration. At the same time, at the January conference, we had no idea what the priorities were going to be for the most part. But despite all of this, CRE debt market has remained really functional. And so it was really interesting to see what folks are focused on. I do have some more color on each of those 5 points in the article. So I would encourage folks to check that out. We'll link it in the show notes and feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions about it. But Omar, I think we've got a couple of announcements before we let folks go.
Yeah. And the first announcement we have is on our next CRE Exchange episode, we'll be talking with Professor Phil English. We have been working on some research with the professor, and we've teased it a few episodes back after we came back from an Aries conference in the early spring. But Professor, he will be diving into a little bit more about the genesis of the work, as well as some of the kind of preliminary findings and potential applications. So just tune in for that, which will be coming out in early July. And then in terms of data releases, what's on your radar for this week?
Yeah, it is a holiday week next week, so it's shortened, but we've got a condensed 3 days worth of good data releases I would encourage folks to check out, and I'll write about in the newsletter. But on Tuesday, July 1st, we have S&P Manufacturing PMI, construction spending, and the JOLTS data. Wednesday, we get the ADP employment figures. On Thursday, July 3rd, we've got the employment report, U.S. trade deficit, and factory orders. So a lot of interesting stuff leading up to the 4th. But Omar, I think that is all the time we've got today. But as usual, before we sign off, I want to encourage our listeners, if you do like the show, we would love it if you could rate it, give us 5 stars on Apple or Spotify, or both, and leave us comments there as well. We will read them. But feel free to send us an email, altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program, and we'd just like to hear from you. So Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode soon. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.